The hour of 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Members, today we have a presentation by the University of Minnesota on an update on their budget request. You should have all received by email the March 1st letter from the university asking for a $97.5 million increase in their budget request. So if Vice President Franz and Budget Director Tonneson would come up. And welcome to the committee, and whoever wishes to go first, please identify yourself for the record. Again, members, you should have a copy of the letter in your packets, and that's the reference point for today. So who's going first? Vice President Fran, please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Myron Fran, Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today about our March 1 request. You know, one of the things that we have learned in the last month or so in talking with many of you and having our conversations in the committee as a better understanding of the concerns and issues that surround, that you all have concerning enrollment issues, long-term underfunding by the state for the university and other commitments that need to be made. So what we wanted to do was provide you with what we felt was an amended request, which will be voted on and approved by the Board of Regents this Friday. So this is our preliminary request pursuant to our internal procedures. But thank you for the opportunity. You know, I'll just take 1 minute to mention the original three. The first request we had was for a $45 million incremental increase in each of the next 2 years for our core mission activities, which include compensation increases for our faculty and staff, operational support for our facilities and student support services. That request totals $135 million for the biennium. Second, we requested $30 million recurring appropriation beginning in fiscal 24, for a new Minnesota resident scholarship to recruit Minnesota students to attend college and graduate from any of our campuses, totaling $60 million for the biennium. And third, we requested $5 million beginning in fiscal 24 and continuing thereafter for public safety improvements on all of our campuses, totaling $10 million for the biennium. I will ask Vice President Tonneson to walk through the three additions to the request. As you know, the original request, I think as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, was for $205 million, and now we are asking for an additional $97.5 million, and I'll let Vice President Tonneson walk through that. Those, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Budget Director Tonneson, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Julie Tonneson. I am the Budget Director for the University of Minnesota. And while the original $205 million for the biennium does remain a priority, as Senior Vice President Franz just mentioned, it has been over 6 months since we first identified those needs, however, and since really nothing seems to stand still, two things have prompted us to seek a revision to our original request. Through discussions with the Higher Education Committee chairs and others, we have learned more about the priorities of the state and where our needs happen to intersect with those priorities, and we've learned more about the very real impact that reduced enrollments are having on our campuses. The first of our three new request items is actually before this committee already through a different avenue. We want to formally and officially adopt as part of our request the governor's and lieutenant governor's recommendation in the Office of Higher Education's budget for the American Indian Scholars Program. This program is supported by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council and many others. The governor's recommendation includes $4.5 million for the University of Minnesota to provide a first dollar tuition and fees pathway for eligible American Indian students to complete an undergraduate education. Undergraduate students eligible to receive the waiver on any of our five campuses are Minnesota residents who are enrolled members or citizens of any federally recognized American Indian or Canadian First Nation tribe, or non-resident students who are enrolled members or citizens of a Minnesota tribal nation. As I mentioned, funds would cover tuition and fees, but would also allow for student support services for these students. We see this as a real need in recruiting eligible students to the state and to our campuses, and in serving them successfully through to graduation. In our system, the Morris campus in particular would benefit from this program due to the unique role they play in educating a proportionately large number of Native American and Indigenous students. The second of our three new request items comes about due to a recent update in our tuition revenue estimates. Every year, after the second semester begins, we reforecast revenues based on actual course registrations. And we've discovered that enrollment is down more than anticipated on all of our campuses. We are projecting a $24 million shortfall. So without an increase to our base appropriation in that amount, it will mean further reliance on internal spending reductions and potentially tuition rate increases to balance our budget. The enrollment shortfall is due to a variety of factors exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. We had expected and planned for some reductions, but the magnitude of change was simply greater than we anticipated. Particularly, we are seeing some ongoing and direct impacts of the pandemic, things like economic hardships, health issues, responsibilities at home for childcare, changes in high school experience and expectations, and also actually employment opportunities. The combined impact of those factors, along with some continuing demographic changes, have led to decreases in freshmen at Crookston, Duluth, and Morris in particular, a decrease in student retention, a decrease in graduate and non-resident enrollment, a decrease in credits taken by students, an increase in withdrawals and failure or non-attendance grade, and a decrease in transfers, recently largely due to lower enrollments in community colleges across the region. And on the other end of the spectrum, I should say too that enrollments have declined more than anticipated because more students are progressing through college more rapidly and actually graduating after less time at the university. There are fewer fifth-year students, for example, than there used to be, which is a good thing and something we are striving for, but it is happening at a faster rate than anticipated. And finally, for our third new item, our conversations with this committee and others have shown that there is a lot of interest in a tuition freeze for university students in the next biennium. So to deliver that certainty for resident undergraduate students and to implement a tuition freeze for 2 years, we're asking for $40.5 million in the biennium. This is a slightly updated estimate from earlier this session, but it would take $13.5 million incremental in each of the next 2 years to offset what would otherwise have been a 3.5% rate increase on the Twin Cities campus, up to a 3.5% increase on the Rochester campus, and 1% increases on each of the other three campuses. Those rate assumptions were shared with this committee earlier in the session as early modeling if the university were to receive its full original biennial budget request for core mission support, the $135 million in the biennium outlined by Senior Vice President Franz a few moments ago. It's important to understand that this $40.5 million is requested on top of or is contingent on receiving the increased appropriation for core mission support. Our plan to cover the projected $90 million in cost increases in each of the next 2 years was to seek half from the state, that's the $45 million per year core mission request, and to cover the other half through spending reductions and tuition rate increases. This tuition freeze proposal removes our ability to raise the tuition rates on resident undergraduates. So if we did not get the $45 million per year in core mission support and there was a tuition freeze for resident undergraduate students, it would force significant tuition rate increases on our other student populations, which could further impact enrollment, and substantial internal spending cuts, which would have significant impacts negative on our programs and services. So the two proposals are tied together. And with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes our very brief overview, but we would be happy to answer any questions.
Budget Director Todd, you repeatedly stated that there was an enrollment decline larger than you had anticipated. Mm-hmm. So if you would submit that chart, the 10-year chart that you had submitted earlier, how would that change? I'm going to ask you now to submit it again, but what would the numbers look like at the end of that chart?
Mr. Chair, members, the chart would not change because that actually goes through fall 22, I believe, what you had, which is actual enrollment last fall. What we do when we set the budget, though, is we estimate enrollment and credit-taking patterns and so on and so forth to generate revenue estimates earlier in the year. So we're actually estimating that in this time of the year, in January, February, March, prior to fall. So that would have been in January, February, March of 22. We were estimating our tuition revenue for the current year. We didn't know what it is until fall and then January, second semester. So the chart wouldn't change because that is through fall of 22, but our budget was built on estimates prior to knowing those numbers.
All right. The numbers that you have here are significant changes in your budget request. Mm-hmm. And I'm not arguing that it's probably needed, but my concern is it's coming after 2 months of hearing just on budgets in this committee. So we had stressed in this committee repeatedly budgets. It's my understanding that the MnState system had already anticipated the so-called COVID shortfall in October. And you discovered it exactly when?
Mr. Chair, members, we estimate in January, once the second semester starts, the end of January, that's when we update our estimates for the current year.
All right. Representative, I've got two different lists here. I looked at this one first, so Representative Robbins, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I wanted to follow up on the chair's point about the projected enrollment declines. I realize it's a projection, but you had submitted your budget based on a projection. So if you could tell us what you had projected for enrollment declines and what you are now projecting, and especially what you're anticipating next year. I think us understanding your projections and how that fits into the budget is very essential. Thank you.
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, I don't have before you today what we were estimating for enrollment when we did the budget a year ago. We can get information on that, but I will explain just a little bit about how that works. We actually, in this time of the year, meet with every one of our colleges and our campuses and talk with them specifically about what they are seeing, what they are projecting, what they have, the trend they have experienced, and what they are projecting. And we work college by college and campus by campus in building that estimate. So it will vary by college and by campus overall. That was done, as I mentioned, about a year ago. What we are experiencing now, we are actually doing analysis. Our folks are doing analysis to learn better about what has changed. The things that I mentioned, retention rates, transfer students, and so forth, it's all a more accelerated decrease than what was anticipated, but I don't have the exact, you know, impacts here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And that is, that level of acceleration is what I'm looking for. So if you could share with us campus by campus what you had projected and what now they're projecting the change to be in all the campuses, it would be very helpful because understanding the pace of change and the acceleration is very critical. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I was listening intently, and it sounds like the enrollment is down in Morehead, Crookston, and Morris, but you didn't mention anything about Duluth or the Twin Cities. And most of the reasons given, except for maybe the retention, don't touch at all on the public safety aspects, particularly in the Twin Cities. And the reason I bring that up is that myself and a few other legislators and a whole bunch of concerned parents and even some regents, former and current, did a little walk around Halloween time through the campus, through Dinkytown and through the Marcy Holmes neighborhood, and interacted and talked with several students and kind of saw things for ourselves. And one interesting thing that happened is 20 minutes before this large group were supposed to start walking through everything, there actually was a pistol whipping that happened. So somebody was held up at gunpoint and then actually pistol whipped, and we were cautioned to say, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening even right now. Then we went on the walk, and there were students that had fireworks shot directly at them. We ran into them. They were in a house, and they were all from Stillwater, and they were quite agitated and upset that those fireworks had been shot at them. I believe the night after that, fireworks were shot into one of the fraternity homes and exploded and hurt somebody. And that's just in the span of like 2 days, and I just happened to be there when all of that activity was happening. But students do let me know quite frequently about the level of violence and terror that they experience every single day on the Twin Cities campus. The fact that one student literally said, when I make it home at night, I thank God that I'm still alive. And they should, that's like a war zone. They should not be experiencing trauma to that level and fear, and their cars are being broken into, a carjack, they're being held up at gunpoint, pistol whipped, you know, on and on and on and on. If you, you know, I watch Twitter feeds and different things of live calls to the police and so on. It is a huge problem. And I know that that question was even asked in a regent meeting, and Vice Provost McMaster was asked, is this violence directly causing some of the drop? Well, I would say retention would be a big one, but even the drop in enrollment. And he was emphatic that it was not. So I just see a huge disconnect, because it's certainly a known secret, I guess, an open secret, that there is tremendous violence and fear and trepidation on the Twin Cities campus. But I didn't hear you say anything about that, and I didn't hear you say anything about drop in enrollment in the Twin Cities campus. One would surmise that when parents are telling their kids, please don't go there, I know lots of parents that have said, from all over the suburbs in particular, that know firsthand what's going on, they're not going to send their kids there. So I'm a little bit taken aback that in asking for all this extra money and being concerned about a drop in enrollment, and so the taxpayer is supposed to come up with additional money, that we aren't even talking openly about the violence on the Twin Cities campus, how that's impacting, well, the students in general, but even, you know, later we're going to talk about the hospital, and I know hospital staff are even terrified to go from the hospital front door to their car, and they take all kinds of precautionary measures so that they don't become a victim of violence themselves. So it's pervasive down on the Twin Cities campus, on the around the hospitals there. And I think we need an honest and open conversation about it. So I guess it's more of a statement, and I just don't understand why we're not talking about that as well.
All right, Vice President Franz.
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think I'd have to challenge your description of the openness of our dialogue. Just last Thursday, I believe it was, we had a town hall with the president, chief of University of Minnesota Police Department Clark, chief of Minneapolis Police Department O'Hara, Inspector McGinty from the 2nd Precinct, Council Member Rainville, Council Member Wansley, where we invited people for an hour and a half to come to the campus and discuss issues. We openly discussed a lot of the issues that you're concerned about, and I think the one of the takeaways that we've gotten from, and we also have a bi-monthly meeting of parents, parent safety group, which has been very successful over the last 6 months. So the dialogue and the transparency has been really over the top, we think, and we want to continue that. We've seen a reduction in some of the violent crime rates in and around the Twin Cities campus. Twin Cities campus itself has always been relatively stable, but around the area, as you mentioned, there has been some increased safety concerns, and we are very concerned about each and every one of those safety incidents. We're concerned about our students, our faculty, our staff, and visitors, and we take that very, very seriously. We've been working really diligently. We, in fact, just hired 8 additional police officers in February to bring onto the force to get us back up to 55. We're working toward 71, but I think everyone that we've talked to has been really supportive of the different issues we've engaged in with additional lighting, additional security kiosk around the campus and in Dinky Town. We've had more safety guides for people who need to who would like to have safety guides in the Dinky Town area. We've increased our security personnel. We're going to continue to work on that going forward. We've asked this legislature for additional money to enhance our infrastructure as well as to bring on more police officers. So we take these concerns very seriously, and we think we're seeing some progress. Clearly there's more work to be done, and we're going to continue working until we can assure the safety of everyone. But so anyway, I think the key here is that we are doing a lot with the community, engaging a lot with the community, as I think we should. And I think your concern about that is one we take very seriously, and I appreciate the comment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I referenced that we're not talking about it, I mean here. We're not, I just feel like you just asked for an additional $97.5 million and talked about drop-in enrollment in Morehead, Crookston, and Morris, and gave a whole plethora of reasons why you thought that was, whether it was COVID or retention issues. What I'm saying is this conversation we're having right now is lacking that conversation of the Twin Cities campus and the violence there. That's what I was referring to, whether you've done town halls or other things. I think of one of the first town halls that was done. In fact, one of our staffers was actually in the room. He's one of our more senior staffers, and I watched it on YouTube, watched it as it was unfolding live. And the one thing that I was most taken aback by is that it was the time and place that was chosen was a time that the president herself could only Zoom in for 10 minutes, and then she had to go and teach a class at Harvard. And when somebody asked a question from the audience, because it was supposed to be interactive, and they realized that she was no longer available, there was just a gasp. You could hear it pervasive. So that's kind of where we started these conversations in the most, in an open format. I believe that was the first one that you had had in that sort of format. And you had your chief of police there, and Chief Clark was there, and a few others. Yourself, I believe you were there, Mr. I'm not going to remember your title correctly. Yes, Franz, but I know the title. Forgive me, I can't think of the title right now. Mr. Franz, you were there, but I appreciate the words, and I appreciate that you're saying that there's a concern. We have a really long way to go from we're letting people voice their concerns to actually moving in the direction of the students are safe, because they don't feel safe right now. So I guess that is my point. And we've come, collectively, we've come a little ways, but I think that a lot more conversation is merited. And even we had conversations, some of us members here offline, with one of the gentlemen that's involved in the parents' safety group. And there's still strong concerns of not really being taken seriously and things like that. So I bring that up because I think it's important to discuss in light of a $97.5 million additional ask over the $205 million. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you folks again for being here today. I have a few questions here, and I, looking back on this, I probably should have asked this first question when you presented your original proposal, but I'm going to ask it now. So the your total request for core mission support is a $135 million increase. Can you tell me what that seems like a really broad category to me? Can you tell me what is the percentage increase that $135 million represents?
Budget Director Tonneson, you want to handle that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to do some math. I apologize. I don't know what the $135 million is as an increase over our biennial base. But let me explain just a little bit about the broadness. It is an inflationary type increase, and we assumed roughly a 6% increase in inflation across all of our spending categories, knowing that some will be significantly higher than that and some will be lower. But that was what the increase was based on. In terms of an increase to the appropriation, we can get you that.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, that would be helpful. And that context is helpful, thank you. And then my second question is on this enrollment-driven tuition shortfall. So I guess this is the two-part questions I'm thinking about. Am I correct in understanding that this $48 million figure, this comes from, in essence, and I recognize I'm probably oversimplifying a bit, but you have sort of enrollment numbers, and then you got updated enrollment numbers, and that $48 million roughly represents the shortfall as a result of the change between those two sets of numbers. Am I roughly correct in understanding that?
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, roughly correct, yes. It is enrollment, but it's also credit-taking patterns and enrollment mix, non-resident versus resident, and those types of things, yes.
Thank you. Okay, that, yes, and as I said, I admit I was oversimplifying a bit there. And I the reason that that sort of draws my eye is that, I mean, that's almost half of your current supplemental request and represents nearly a quarter of your original request, which to me, that seems significant. And that's concerning to me for a few reasons. So just kind of wanted to raise that issue as something that I'm sure I'm not the only one that finds some concern with that. The final question I have, this $40.5 million for the tuition freeze, and it says here that is predicated on receiving your full request for the core mission support and the enrollment drive tuition shortfall. So by my math, that's approximately $223.5 million. If we, I mean, 135 plus 48 plus 40.5 gets us to 223.5. That 223.5, does that represent the amount of state funding the university would need to hold tuition flat?
Budget Director Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think about it as the 45 million, the 135 and the 40.5, they are linked because one of our tools in addressing the other half of that 45 per year piece is to raise tuition. And so it is a way to think about, rather than the state contributing 45 million toward our 90 of annual costs, it would be contributing 58 million toward that 90. So they're intricately linked. The 24 million, which I should mention and make clear just because it was a little bit confusing to some, that is a tuition shortfall on all campuses, Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and the Twin Cities. That is and represents an increase over the 90 of cost increase that we were anticipating. It's another, think about it as another cost increase on top of the 90. So it isn't as directly linked, but they are in fact all representing need of the university in order to maintain what we're doing today. I should say too that the increase, the 24 million, honestly, in most years we are very accurate in our tuition estimates. We're within 1% generally. This year we are off. And so something has definitely changed this year compared to normal and is higher than anticipated.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. And that's helpful information as well. I guess, and maybe we can take this offline because I don't want to take up too much more time. I guess I'm still a little unclear to me. It's still a little unclear to me exactly sort of what the dollar figure is that the university would need to hold tuition flat. Maybe that's the way I should have asked the question. But one final question, I guess, is, you know, in your original budget request, there was not a specific line item for a tuition freeze. And I guess, to be blunt, I'm just curious, why not? Why was that not in your original request? Why is that coming in a supplemental request?
Vice President Franz, I'm interested in your answer on this one, too.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. It's a really good question. I mean, part, as you know, the art of preparing a request is uncertain at best. And I think one of the concerns we had is we wanted to make sure that in the $45 million request, the core mission, we wanted to make sure that you all appreciated our willingness to partner in trying to control cost and tuition going forward. And we felt that was a really good way to do that. We didn't put a tuition freeze on the table because that was, we felt like the pressures on trying to you know, make sure you come up with budgets that can fit within your targets. We felt that that was just maybe just a step too far. But one of the things we've learned in the last month or so is the enormous pressure, and not just pressure, but interest in us pursuing that. So we wanted to go back to the drawing board table and say, okay, if we are able to do that, here's a way that we can do that. Because I think everyone's talking a lot about enrollment pressures, right? And so, to the extent the state of Minnesota can take that on for a two-year period for the university and whatever you might do for the Minnesota State, that would be a tremendous signal on behalf of the state of Minnesota for higher education to have that sort of withheld holding a two-year pattern. So, you know, we felt like we learned more when we came over here, the more interest in enrollment concerns, and that this might be a valid tool to do that. So we just didn't do it initially because we felt like we wanted to try to keep our original $205 million request as tightly as we could to show the partnership for the $45 million core request. But it's here we are today. So thank you.
Representative Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to say that I appreciate that reasoning, but it surprises me a little bit to hear that it did not, that maybe this committee did not adequately signal that that was a priority, because certainly that's the signal I've been trying to send. Because, and I, if you'll excuse my language, to be frank, the tuition is too damn high. And, you know, we had this meeting the other evening where we forwarded candidates for the Board of Regents. And I'm not going to, you know, suggest that everybody holds to this standard, but one standard that was put forward was the idea that a student should be able to make during the summer what they make, or what would cost, what the tuition cost would be for the academic year. And being the son of a University of Minnesota educated math teacher, I did the math on that. And in order to almost, not even entirely, almost cover tuition at the Twin Cities and Duluth campuses, a student, someone working 40 hours a week for 12 weeks, not taking a single day off, would have to have the equivalent take-home pay of someone making more than $60,000 a year. Now, I don't know that there are a lot of college students out there who can get jobs making 60 grand a year, and that would only barely cover tuition at Morris. And that's, I mean, that's not even obviously the full cost of attendance. That doesn't include room and board or books or meals, or I mean, to be frank, I think we should factor beer into that equation, but I'll live to fight another day. And it seems to me that there is a for lack of a better term, misalignment between the priorities that I think this committee and others have made pretty clear and what the university has put forward with their budget. So I guess better late than never, but coming in March with another $97.5 million is an interesting approach. Thank you.
Vice President Franz.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. Well, I think, you know, first of all, there's two ways I would answer that. I could tell you that when I went to college, I worked during the summer, and I worked during school, and I still took out loans. So I think the ability to do what you're suggesting has always been an issue and always been a problem. So, but the other issue here that we need to, I think, step back and realize is that from our perspective, the state's support of higher education is about $246 million below what it should be this year. That's based on a 2008 projection when we received a little over $700 million that year. And this last year, we received a little over $700 million. Again, if you keep in, if you attach inflation to that, that's a $246 million drop in the support by the state for the University of Minnesota. So that's part of the problem. There has been continual underfunding by the state for the University of Minnesota for a long time, and I think that needs to be corrected. So our goals, you know, we didn't come in and ask for the $246 million difference, but I think the challenge here is what are the right tools, what are the right points that we want to hit, and your points are well taken, and I appreciate your comments, sir.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to some of these projections and that whole issue. And my understanding is that you've had to revise projections before based on new information. Does that happen regularly? And I believe you stated that it averages about 1% difference. If you could just verify that that's what you would say.
Budget Director Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, and it varies again by college and campus, but every year we do an updated estimate at this time of the year in January and work with the colleges to understand how that varies from what they originally planned. Our original estimates are usually, you take a college like the College of Liberal Arts on the Twin Cities campus, it's our largest student population. Their tuition estimate is always within a point of 1 to 1.5% of actual up until this year. And I don't have exactly what that college is in front of me, but that is true, that our methods of estimating tuition have been close enough so that every year when we go through this process, most colleges are in very close proximity to what they estimated. There might be a couple that are off, and we work with them individually to solve that challenge within the university and within their particular college. This year, almost all of our colleges and campuses are off by significant amounts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so even with the ongoing declining enrollment at, for instance, Morris and some of these other campuses where it's, we've seen the charts where it's been going down, those are all predicted declines?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they predicted a portion of the decline, but they fell short in the estimate. The number that comes to mind, for example, on the Duluth campuses, they built in an enrollment reduction, I want to say around 110, and the actual enrollment reduction this year is around 300. So there was a significant change from what they anticipated as a drop.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so as a percentage, I mean, I know you say you don't have those numbers in front of you, but are we talking 10%? Are we talking 5%? If you could ballpark it for us to give us an idea, I think that might be helpful.
Budget Director Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, our tuition revenue each year is approaching $1 billion, so $24 million off of the estimated 900 and some thousand million would be, you know, close to what, 2%? 2.5%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so have you ever come back to the legislature based on declining enrollment or based on, you know, having to, based on the actual data once you get it in January, have you ever come back to the legislature and asked for more money?
Budget Director Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not in my memory. We have handled those on a case-by-case basis by college inside. Because, it has been much more targeted, one college, two colleges, rather than all of them.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of surprised that you would come to this committee and ask for more money without knowing those numbers and percentages that you could provide for the committee. I look forward to getting those offline, but I feel like that would have been something that, you know, the university would have thought would have been a question that we were going to ask in order to make, you know, our decision easier here. So thank you for allowing that line of questioning, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to briefly respond to Representative Marianne O'Neill's remarks regarding the safety of the U of M. I also go to the U of M sometimes. They have good boba teas and one of the best Korean hot dogs and a really nice Chinese family local restaurant there. I will walk there with my friends day in the evening, and I've had quite a pleasant experience. And so, Representative, I'm not dismissing what you experienced. I think, you know, what I experienced is also very true too as well. And I think, you know, as we talk about enrollment and what's driving costs, let's have a little rounded conversation about this. And with that, I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Budget Director Tonneson, you mentioned repeatedly that tuition would go up more than you predicted, or tuition increases would go up. Can you tell us what the tuition increases would be by campus if you didn't get the $97.5 million?
Mr.
And
Chair,
if you can't right now, we're not taking this offline. I want these numbers presented to the committee. And this is going to have to be in short order, too, because we've already got first deadline coming at Friday. I anticipate, hopefully, budget targets by the middle of the month. So if you can't get it to me now, I want it before or as we get budget targets. And if members don't get this offline, I want this presented in committee now. So.
Mr. Chair, I do not have an answer for that today. We will have to go back and discuss that.
All right, we're going to have you back soon. So perhaps even Thursday, if it works. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to apologize to the committee for being late. I had another commitment at the exact same time, so it's impossible to be two places at once. And I just want to say thank you. When I receive these documents, I'm not wholly surprised by the number and the requests, having followed the university for quite some time and following your requests for quite some time. And the disinvestment that this body has made in the University of Minnesota. I have always thought that it would be best if we truly understood the needs of the university and not to have you come to this committee and just say what you think you can get. I know these are really uncomfortable conversations to have, but if we don't have them and if we don't have them in public, then the public has no idea of what we need to truly invest. And when I'm thinking about the detailed budget books that you have prepared for us in the past, and during my time, and this is only my fifth year, so I have seen those detailed budget books, and to see the reallocation that has occurred in trying to prevent tuition increases, I know that the hard work of the university is happening. And we need this institution to be healthy. We need this institution to be viable on all five campuses. And it is an important economic driver for our state. And it cannot be left out of the conversation, the three critical aspects that you do. And it isn't apples to apples when we compare it to other educational institutions. So I need you to be very clear, very detailed in what you need from us, but please never be afraid to say these are the gaps that we have in order to fulfill our mission. So thank you, Chair, for giving me this space to say those things. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's go back to this, the beginning of this conversation. And in your testimony, you said that this ask to the legislature will be on the Regents Board agenda on Friday, which means they've not discussed this, they've not approved this, but administration is coming here to ask the legislature. I have a problem with that because your board that we duly elect to govern haven't even discussed this in a board meeting, approved it, and sent it to us. So I have a big problem with that. I want to know how many other times in the recent past has that happened, where the board hasn't even approved something, and the administration comes to us and asks us for additional, whatever it is, budget or other things.
Vice President Frantz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think earlier this year, for example, the bonding bill proposal that the university submitted to the to the legislature and to the governor was submitted as a preliminary proposal by the board that had been reviewed by the board but not been acted upon, hadn't been voted by the board. We try to make sure that the board has an opportunity to review our requests, legislative requests, in 1 month and then take action in a later month. That just doesn't always work out in terms of the calendar sometimes. So, but in this particular regard, we move forward only with, after advising the board of our requests and seeking approval to issue a preliminary request pending board approval on Friday. So it was with the board leadership approval and authorization that we would go forward, and they've been briefed about all the details and will make their final action on Friday.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say board leadership, are you referring to the chair? Like, what do you mean by the chair, the vice chair? Like, which people are making these decisions and which people are being briefed, as a, in short, of the entire regent board, which are constitutionally responsible for the university?
Vice President Pratt.
Mr. Chair, all board members have been briefed. about this issue and about the proposal. All board members have been briefed. The authorization to proceed was by the chair and vice chair of the board, pending approval on Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice President Franz, what exactly will the regions be voting on?
They'll be voting on the $97.5 million addition to the $205 million request.
That doesn't exactly answer my question. I want, what detail will be presented to the regions?
Mr. Chair, they have the detail that you see in front of you and additional detail that's been provided before. So they'll have this detail, and they'll be able to question us, as you have as well.
Did the regions receive the detail of the declining enrollment that I requested that presented to this committee over the last 10 years by campus? Did they receive that information?
Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar if they have that or not. I'd have to check on that.
Did the regions receive, because we had to find out, the variable tuition increases by campus? Did they receive that information when they voted on your primary budget request?
Mr. Chair, they are aware of the variable tuition rates and increases that we have around the campuses. We will present our proposed budget not until May or June, I guess, of this year. So they won't see our final recommendations until this June after the session is over.
But Vice President Franz, if they were aware, but why weren't we until we requested it?
Mr. Chair, you know, we try to present you with all the information we anticipate that you want, but we don't always get that right, and we try to respond when we get additional questions, which is the nature of our ongoing relationship with the legislature. We always try to listen to questions and answer as best we can.
Vice President Franz, I would hope in the future that you would give us all the detail and not hold anything back, particularly when we're talking about tuition increases. Because what was presented to this committee was a flat rate across all the campuses until you were pressed, and then we discovered that there was a variable tuition increase by campus. I'm not arguing against those types of tuition increases. I would just like to make them public so that we understand exactly what you're presenting to us and why we need to vote for these numbers. So I would hope that the regents would see exactly what we're seeing, and that when they're voting on Friday, they would know at least as much as we know.
Mr. Chair, it's my assumption that they do, and that we try to make sure that they have that access to all that information and our briefing to the board.
All right. In the future, when we have budget hearings, I would hope that this type of detail would be presented as an automatic, that we would get as much information as possible on your budget increases and needs. I'm not arguing against any of this. I think there is a need out there. At least I'm hoping there's a need, because there's a big difference between a need and a want. And right now there is a crisis situation here with declining enrollment. So with that, we'll end this discussion for today, but we are coming back to this discussion soon, maybe even as early as Thursday. So we'll move on to the next item on the agenda. And before we have the university present, I would like Mr. Hopkins to walk us through a brief history of the University of Minnesota Hospital System and content. And members, you have this in your packet, so I'll turn it over to Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins from House Research. At the chair's request, I prepared a memo for the committee to provide some history and context regarding the University of Minnesota's hospital system. That memo is in members' packets. I'm just going to summarize it briefly here from the table.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
We have four or five of these. Could you just give us
the
memorandum?
Members, there's a memorandum
right in the front.
By
Thank
Mr. Hopkins, and it's dated March 3rd, 2023. It's the University of Minnesota Hospital System History and Contents. He's going to walk us through this, and I would hang on to this for future reference, members. We don't have a bill before us. This issue is going to be before Health and Human Services and Commerce, likely. So we'll be probably revisiting this, too. So, Representative McDonald, do you have it? Okay. Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, so when the legislature established the University of Minnesota in 1851, the territorial legislature, it provided for a Department of Medicine. But it wasn't until 1888 that the university's medical department was finally established. The first hospital that the University of Minnesota established was in 1911, and that was Elliott Memorial Hospital. And this was intended to be, as all university hospitals and academic medicine facilities are intended to be, sort of a locus where you combine patient care, medical research, and physician training. But in 1911, the university hospital served primarily a charitable mission. It was not meant to be revenue generating at all. That changed rather quickly. As soon as 1915, charge of 10 cents per patient visit was imposed. But primarily early on, these were meant to be charitable hospitals. More facilities were added to the university's hospital and clinic portfolio throughout the 20th century, and there's a quick list of those on page 3 of the memo. But to really jump ahead, things began to change significantly in the 1960s when Medicare and Medicaid were established. There were less uninsured persons in the United States, and so the charitable mission of university hospitals became less central. But the real purpose of them was still combining that patient care, cutting-edge medical research, and training for physicians. The university hospitals began to focus on specialized, high-end care, and there was also pricing a lot of its care to support and subsidize its research and training missions. In the 1980s, there was the cost of care in the United States, medical care began to rise significantly, and there were a lot of regulatory and competitive pressures that were new. Payers, insurance companies, public and private payers, were watching their bottom line, and they were sending their enrollees to hospitals with low costs. They didn't want to pay the premiums for teaching and research. So you have this increasingly competitive medical marketplace, and everyone's trying to lower prices for patients and for payers. Also in that environment, the university's market share remained relatively small, less than 10% in the state of Minnesota compared to other systems, which were consolidating in order to adjust to that new competitive marketplace. A lot of other systems had market shares around 25% or more, compared to the university's around 10%. So the university hospitals really lacked the patient volume that it needed in order to cover its costs for that high-end, cutting-edge care. In addition, the university had a lot of debt still from a construction of a new hospital in 1986. So going into the 1990s, the university hospitals found themselves in a position where they needed a lot more patient volume. They needed more bargaining leverage with insurers, and fundamentally they needed more revenue to cover their costs. But the university hospitals had to remain uniquely and absolutely committed to combining patient care with research and training. That's the point of academic medicine. So it wouldn't really work to just sell the university hospitals to a private system, because no private system wants to take ownership over those expensive functions of teaching and research. That's fundamentally a public function of the university as an educating institution and as a research institution. So the university went into the marketplace and sort of looked for a partner, a private system to partner with, and it was clear that the arrangement would have to be some sort of cooperative one rather than a cash sale. The university entered negotiations with multiple systems in the mid-90s. Ultimately, Fairview offered the most promising option, and after a year of negotiations, in January of 1997, the university and Fairview entered into a series of agreements regarding the operation and the operation of the university hospital system. That relationship deepened further in 2018 when the university and Fairview began jointly marketing medical services under a single brand of mHealth Fairview. Mr. Chair, unless there are any questions or more detail.
Members, do you have any questions for Representative Klebar?
Thank you, and this is to Mr. Hopkins. So, Mr. Hopkins, when I was looking into the initial transfer, I was very much concerned about the charitable authority. Do you have any idea as to what authority the University of Minnesota had? I looked at the Lord case, but I'm not an attorney, But I wondered about the authority that they had to transfer charitable assets, university assets, well, they're both charitable and university assets, to a private entity.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, so the Lord case deals with the University of Minnesota's constitutional autonomy, yeah. And under the case law that's developed the idea of constitutional autonomy for the University of Minnesota, internal management of the university is committed to the Board of Regents. And so the decision to enter into the agreement of Fairview would be one that would be committed to the Board of Regents. Now, if there are laws regarding, you know, the sale of charitable assets, those would all still apply. The University of Minnesota's constitutional autonomy doesn't make it above generally applicable laws in Minnesota. So laws dealing with charitable assets and their disposition and sale would still apply to the University of Minnesota. But the decision ultimately rests with the Board of Regents as the governing body of the university.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. Again, to Mr. Hopkins, and I hate to put you on the hot seat, and if you don't know, please just say you don't know. So one of the questions I had about this transfer of property, could you please tell me, do you know, was the legislature involved in any part of that process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, there were legislative hearings leading up to the 1997 agreement with Fairview. I don't know exactly how much the legislature was involved and what bills were introduced regarding it. My understanding is that there were no laws that were passed that directly implicated the sale.
And I have, thank you. This will be my last question. I thank you for your indulgence. Do you know, did the Attorney General review these contracts for transfer of charitable assets prior to the signing of these documents in the transfer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, I do not know what position the Attorney General took and how involved the Attorney General's office was in the 1997 agreement with Fairview.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think we should, thank you, Chair Pulaski. I think that we should ask the Attorney General's office if they have signed off on the transfer of charitable assets with this deal in 1997, and if so, on what authority would they have entered into that agreement?
Representative Cleaver, we'll make that request.
Thank you.
Any other questions at this point? Seeing none, then we'll come back to Vice President France for part two. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record again. And I believe there is information dealing with the health care issue in your pack.
Mr. Chair, my name is Myron Franz. I'm the Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota. And I might just take this moment to address Representative Cleavorn's question, not to dispositively, but to indicate that one of the things that occurred was that the Fairview system amended its mission to include education and research, and as part of their mission going forward, to allow for that transfer or to help make that transfer happen. And part of that was, and there were a lot of other agreements in place that or provisions that made sure that the Fairview system supported the academic health mission of the university. So that transfer was not simply the transfer of a building. It was the transfer of a academic health practice that would combine the East Bank Hospital with the West Bank Hospital under this new umbrella and mission of the Fairview system, working with the University of Minnesota to promote and develop the academic health practice in that larger system. That's the most detail I have about that. I thought it'd be helpful to have that for you.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you. Then my question would be, and this would be information that I would like to have at a later time, right? Whenever you, so good for them becoming a nonprofit, okay? But the question I would have is, were then the avenues opened up to other nonprofits who would have agreed to that mission, or was it solely for them to get this deal through?
Vice President Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know definitively. My understanding is that Mr. Hopkins mentioned, there weren't a lot of takers at that time and that wanted to step up and incorporate the academic health practice within their community hospital system. So it's my understanding that Fairview was the system that was willing to do that, and I think there were a 501c3 before that, but they amended their mission to include the academic health practice. So I think it was a nature of, Mr. Hopkins mentioned, the healthcare industry at that time was extremely competitive, and it was difficult to get insurers and payers to pay that increased price that came along with academic health practice. So that's my understanding of how that happened.
Mr. Chair, may I have one more?
Please, please.
Thank you. And I think the point of my question is maybe getting lost in the conversation of what happened. The point of my conversation is this is prime real estate land attached to the brand of the University of Minnesota. That brand, that land, has value to the state. And this transfer was made, and I want to be sure that the state received full compensation for that transfer at that time. And if not, I want to know why. And then if the state is being asked to now purchase back property that was transferred at potentially below market value at that time because it was desperate or whatever excuse we want to use, I want to make sure that state assets are used appropriately. That's my question. So, and maybe you don't have the answer for that, but it's something that we need to look at, because if it was transferred at below market value, then I want that same reduction if the state would be asked to purchase it back, so, or transfer it back.
How much time do I have?
Well, yeah. we have been permission to go past our allotted time. The chair usually does not do that, but in this case, we might do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, you're raising an excellent point. In fact, that's the point of our five-point plan, as we've talked about, the vision that the university has is to, first of all, make sure that we continue to develop a world-class academic health system, integrating research, teaching, and care delivery to ensure cutting-edge care. Point two of that is for the university governance and control of those flagship facilities we're talking about, to make sure that's essential to our delivery of the academic health care. Point three is that we have strategic partnerships with other health systems, like we have now with Fairview, to make sure there's a continuum of that care in the community and we have patients and places for doctors to practice. Point four is a future state-of-the-art hospital to replace the East Bank Hospital, because it's an aging facility. And then part five is an investment of our current facilities to bridge the new replacement. So in part two of that we're really talking about here, point two of that, we want to make it quite clear that we're not talking about a sale of a building or an asset. We're talking about the fact that these assets, both university assets and Fairview assets, were contributed to this ongoing joint enterprise of providing health care for the people of Minnesota. They are public assets, if you will. And so we don't think that, we think the fair market value of purchase is not the right correct analysis. What we really need to look at is those assets were imbued with charitable qualities because of the public contribution, state contribution, and donor contributions into those facilities, especially like the Masonic Children's Hospital. So it's our view that as we take a look at those, particularly those four facilities and their support of and part of an academic health practice that has buildings but also has a practice, it has people who work in those facilities. So when we talk about reacquiring the flagship facilities, we're talking about everything that goes on inside of those buildings, and that we have to look at those assets in terms of their support for the public mission of the university, their support for public health for the state of Minnesota. And that is why we believe that we estimated $300 million for part one of the reacquisition, but that's based on preliminary analysis, and there's some costs that were going to have to happen as part of any acquisition or reacquisition of assets. But I will be clear, we do not believe that there's a fair market value analysis that goes to these assets. There's a charitable asset evaluation about where they belong to support the academic health system. And we're saying at this point, the university is saying, we believe that they're better governed under the University of Minnesota conditions because under the merger as currently proposed by Fairview. And let me back up. We oppose the merger of Fairview and Sanford under the current structure because that structure has the ultimate authority of these flagship assets under a parent South Dakota entity. We believe that these flagship assets on the campus of the University of Minnesota need to be governed by, operated by the University of Minnesota. There have been some statements by Sanford about to have a regional board to monitor the or to govern the Minnesota assets. Well, they can do some of that, but you cannot simply delegate and relieve all of the parent board duties from South Dakota to a sub-board, if you will. So we're concerned about that transfer. We think it's important, and that's why we've come to you and the legislature to make sure that, and the Attorney General, to make sure that you all understand that these assets have been invested in by the state, by the people of Minnesota, and we believe they need to be governed, controlled, and operated by the University of Minnesota. So that's our current position in terms of what's happening. You know, and I think Mr. Hopkins' description of what was going on prior to 1996 is really helpful in this case because a lot has changed since 1996. And a lot of people might ask, well, why can the University of Minnesota now step up and run these facilities when we decided not to do so or back in 1996 for those various reasons? I think one of the things that happened, you know, back in 1996, I think the annual operating revenue of the East Bank Hospital or the University of Minnesota Medical Center was under $400 million, and it's now over $2 billion a year. One of the things that happened is that we've increased our clinical faculty dramatically since 1996. In fact, UMP, University of Minnesota Physicians, did not even exist as an entity until after the merger took place in 1997. It is now an independent faculty group, doctor group, and we have about 1,600 doctors and specialists that work in that group that coordinate their care with the Fairview, University of Minnesota Health Fairview system. So one of the things that UMP was created in part was to provide this clinical work supporting the academic health practice with the research and the teaching and the patient care all combined. And that practice, as I mentioned, has grown significantly. One of the things also that in 1996 we had, the state created the Medical Education Research Cost Program called MERC. Now that's called the Healthcare Workforce and Innovation Fund. But this fund now compensates hospitals that are providing education and training for the next generation of physicians. That did not exist prior to 1996. That's one of the reasons the university was having trouble competing with other systems because they were not supporting this part of the education and training of doctors. So there were a lot of things that have happened since that time. We now, as you know, train over 70% of all the doctors in the state of Minnesota, and we train a lot of other professionals, nurses, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals, public health folks, dentists. So the University of Minnesota, as you may have noticed last week, the University of Minnesota Medical School was ranked 29th in the country for National Institute of Health funding research, and now we moved up to number 21. We're in the top tier of universities doing research from NIH, which is a very critical component of the stature and ability of a medical school and its faculty to attract and retrain those talented doctors, the talented research folks that continue to help make the University of Minnesota such an incredibly important part of the landscape for the development of healthcare in the state of Minnesota. So we're quite concerned about the current merger and its current trajectory because we believe that in order for this merger to proceed, it needs to make sure that, first of all, the University of Minnesota and its proposal here is dealt with and agreed upon between the parties before they go to the next step. And, you know, we're certainly willing and have been working with both Fairview and Sanford to discuss what a strategic partnership might look down the road. But that is, as we talk about that is after we've been able to to acquire and begin operation of those facilities. I think I'll leave it there for now and just allow for some questions, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
We have more members with questions, but I think I'm going to give you a rest just for a second. And Representative Wolgamont has three important motions for us. So, Representative Wolgamont, your first motion.
Mr. Chair, first, I would like to move the approval of the minutes of this committee from February 1st, 2023.
Representative Wolgamont moves the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved.
Mr. Chair, did he say February 21st or 1st?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I said February 21st.
Okay. Thank you. I thought he said first, so thank you.
And he was present at that. Representative Wolgamott.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to move the approval of minutes from February 28th of the calendar year 2023.
Representative Wolgamott moves the minutes of February 28th. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Knorr.
Is it the 27th or 28th?
Is there a typo on that? All right, we will amend the motion to correct the. Okay, Representative Wolgamott amends his motion. Representative Knorr, thank you for that catch. To the correct date. And renews his motion on the minutes. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And one last set, and let's hope that everything's okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, let's hope that the third time is the charm here, as I move the approval of the minutes from March 2nd, 2023.
Representative Wolgamott moves the minutes of March 2nd. Any discussion? Any correction? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Thank you all, particularly for those that caught on to exact dates. And now we're returning to the topic before us. Representative Hicks is next.
Thank you, Chair. As I've been listening to this discussion and following, one of the questions I have is going back to why the university has a hospital around to, quote, our researcher, care of the poor. How has this current situation, or how do you see the proposal for change, should you separate, affect those in Minnesota who are underinsured? We have tons of Minnesotans who have commercial health insurance, but their deductibles are $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 out-of-pocket maxes, $35,000 out-of-pocket maxes, numbers that are completely not feasible for many, many people. And I'm wondering how this could benefit those folks in our community who currently can't afford to seek care even though they're insured. Or, if it doesn't, I would like to hear about why.
Vice President Pratt.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to call a friend up to help me with this, Dean Toler, if that's acceptable. And I'll start off by responding, Representative, excellent question and great concern. Part of the mission of the University of Minnesota is to increase access and to our care. I mean, one of the things that, which is one of the reasons we have a number of relationships around the state with different systems, is not only do we want to develop innovative healthcare, new treatments, new techniques that literally save lives and make people's lives better, we want to make sure that it's delivered to the people who, all the people who need those. If it's okay, Mr. Chair, let Dean Toler.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jacob Toler. I'm a bone marrow transplant physician, and I serve as the Dean of Medical School and Vice President for Clinical Affairs. Thank you for the question.
Dean Toler, could you just say your last name for us?
T-O-L-A-R. People in New Prague would identify it immediately.
Thank you very much. All right. Dean Toler.
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question. The underserved in the state of Minnesota and anywhere in the United States is, I think, the one of the biggest burdens on public, sort of moral, social, upkeep of who we are. And the University of Minnesota is a land-grant university, has always looked at the service to Minnesotans of any background, any socioeconomic status, any race, any language group, or anybody. That is what distinguishes private and public institutions in healthcare industry, because we are not driven by profit. We are not driven by business of healthcare alone. We are driven by alleviation of human suffering in general. We have been always open to people of any insurance, if you will, and there are some entities in the state and in the United States that don't do that. So we do serve as a, I hesitate to say that, but it's almost like Hennepin County Medical Center saves, is a safety net for Hennepin County. We are sort of safety net for the state of Minnesota, because anybody can come, and anybody does come. And in part, the reason we have, if you allow me, anemic margins in the business is in part because we do shoulder the costs that are brought upon us by industries that are in healthcare but do not serve the patients to the best. So to answer your question, it is not only the maintenance of our commitment to all Minnesotans, but it's also that I see the academic environment of the university as the only solution to get out of the, again, if you allow me, misery of American healthcare business. Because we pay as Americans twice as much as comparable societies in the world, and we have less than average outcomes. I mean, that's horrible. 41% Americans have medical debts. My patients, not only that they have leukemia, you know, their daughter has leukemia, so they are heartbroken forever, but they lose their house, their parents sell their house, and not because the treatment is any better, you know, it's because we pay the profits, if I may say that, for the ancillaries, if you will. So 1 in 8 Americans has more than 10,000 medical debt. This is medical debt is the number one reason for bankruptcy in the United States. This is just not fine. This is just not normal. And I don't have time, but I can, you know, people use this offline thing, to explain how idiosyncratic is American United Health United States healthcare system. It's totally idiosyncratic. And I had a benefit of practicing on the other side of the Atlantic and in different systems that are not like that. And I can tell you this is not inevitable. This doesn't have to be that way. So I'm going to end my response by saying that the only hope for United States healthcare business is going to come from academia, because we will bring forward the value-based care. We will bring forward not just paying for more for the same things, but rather an oblique way of how to emancipate patients to make their own decisions and to put physicians and other healthcare providers, nurses, pharmacists, and so forth in the position of decision-making that the patients actually want. And we can do this because we have improved the care models. We have improved the digital way, the virtual care. This is the only place where this can happen, and that's why if we want to have better health care in the state of Minnesota, and I think it would be copied elsewhere, we should protect, and that's going back to the senior vice president's comments, we should protect the unique and irreplaceable resource that the University of Minnesota Medical School and its clinical arm is.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. As someone who had a child that has had 24 hospitalizations, 10 of which are pediatric ICU stays, I am very familiar with that cycle, both personally and with many of the families that I met on the PICU floor. And so it is an absolutely true statement that we need to figure out how to support Minnesotans to get the care they need when they need it. And I am happy to hear that this is also your mission. So thank you.
Representative Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for coming to discuss this with us today. I have so many questions. And so I hope we have further time for discussing this in the future.
Representative Robbins, this is not the last time we'll have this before us. So
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my initial question is, it seems like, Vice President French, you said that it's very important that the university hospitals be governed, controlled, and operated by the U of M. That is not currently the case. My understanding is that there's joint board control in the agreements that you have with Fairview, and that Fairview has amended their bylaws to absorb the academic mission, all of that. So currently, you do not control them directly. So why would that similar arrangement not that you already have existing with Fairview not transfer to Sanford? And I'm not understanding, if it wasn't based in South Dakota and some other Minnesota-based health system wanted this partnership, why would you not transfer that existing arrangement where it is joint control? Why is it necessary to retake all control? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so right now on the Fairview Board, the university has three board positions. And that's been that way for a long time. And when the, just a little bit of background, when the mission of the Fairview was changed to include the support of academic health, at that time, the bylaws and provisions of the agreements that designated the three university positions made it clear that those university-designated representatives, like Dr. Toler and myself, are there to represent the university. So there's no sort of a potential conflict of interest there, which is kind of unusual in a board in some ways, but it's clear that the three representatives are there to represent the views of the university. However, being only three, obviously, as you indicated, that's not control. And right now, the control mechanism for the university and the Fairview lasts until 2026. So under the current arrangement, if Fairview and Sanford would merge, the Sanford would be obligated to respect that agreement through 2026. But what's different about that arrangement now is that the new board for Sanford, the controlling the parent board, would be based in South Dakota and would be a super board on top of any Minnesota board. So that super parent board, the parent board that would roll up all the controls and decisions to the South Dakota parent, would have ultimate authority and control over the assets and decisions in all of its different regions, whether it's North Dakota or Minnesota or South Dakota. So that's one of our concerns, is the ultimate control would no longer be in the Fairview board that we are members of. It would be in the parent board in South Dakota. The other thing that's been a little troubling for us is that about a year ago, when the merger was first discussed between Fairview and Sanford, at that time, they began discussions in spring of 2022, and we were informed about it on August 7th in 2022. And even being board members, we were unaware of, not informed of, not given any indication or opportunity to participate in that discussion. It's really now become clear to, and I'm speaking now me as a senior vice president for the university, that those kinds of decisions need to be developed through the partnership with your clinical partners. So we are the clinical partner with Fairview now under the mHealth Fairview arrangement. And for Sanford and Fairview to begin those discussions without the university participating ignored the fact that there were some business reasons for Sanford and Fairview to talk to one another. Obviously, Fairview lost like $300 million last year, unsustainable. Sanford wants to get into the Twin Cities market. They want to combine. From a business point, it might make sense, but from a public asset discussion that we're talking about earlier, Fairview had committed to and has committed to working on this academic health system with the university. And so our concern was, even with the three board positions on the current Fairview board, we were not advised of and didn't get a chance to participate in the development of this letter of intent between Fairview and Sanford. So we believe that going forward, to have that control mechanism ultimately reside in the South Dakota parent board, it would cause us concern about control and governance of those assets. I didn't mean to get too windy on that, but I'm trying to tie it all together because you asked very thoughtful questions.
Thank you for that, and I understand your concern, but I would just suggest that contracts can be designed anyway. I don't think it's without question that the existing relationship could be built in and joint ownership and control could continue. And to that point, just before you respond, I see that Fairview has sent a letter to the university dated yesterday offering to sell all the assets to you. Have you responded to that? And what, if they're willing to do that, is that something you're entertaining?
Vice President Fran.
Mr. Chair, we have responded to that. I don't have the letter in front of me. I can get that to you, all response letter. We appreciate that response, but it kind of goes back to the discussion we were having with Representative Cleavorn earlier. The idea of a sale is really contrary to the nature of the academic health system that we're working with Fairview on right now. So our position is that we need to analyze the academic health practice and those assets that have been contributed to that enterprise, and how do those assets get continue on to make sure that they continue to support the University of Minnesota's academic health mission, which is why they were designed, how everyone invested in them. So that's one concern about their response, is the idea of a sale doesn't give credence to the charitable nature of these assets and how they need to be treated under law. The other thing that concerned us, in fact, in the letter that we responded to Fairview and Sanford, we indicated we appreciated the support of our five-point plan from Fairview and Sanford. We thought that was a good step forward, and we asked them we assume that this means they will delay the May 31 merger date because we won't have time to finalize any agreements by that point. And their response was no, they intend to continue to pursue the May 31 merger date. So again, our concern is that once the merger happens, it'll be much more difficult for the university or the state of Minnesota to make sure that those charitable assets are used in the way that they should be to support the mission of the university. Anything you want to add, Dr. Toler?
Dean Toler.
If that's all right.
Dean Toler.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Question, you know, and it's a complicated idea, but it's very simple. With the proposed letter of intent that we have, you know, now between Fairview and Sanford, this is going to be governed from another state that has, you know, different political and different geographical ideas about how to do this. Sanford Health System is a very good system, very profitable, but it has no evidence of experience in urban healthcare or academic healthcare. The second problem is that the university, by intent, not being involved in this, had no say in shaping this. And as Senior Vice President Fan said, this is not a business question alone. This is a public question. This is a question for the state of Minnesota, whether we want to have a vibrant academic practice that trains 70% of physicians in the state. That is the only answer to the comment that Representative Hicks, you know, had before. That is the only answer to your quest, our quest, to have rural physicians. Do we want to have that or not? So the exclusion of the university by intent and framing this as a business deal rather than a public question is a second problem. And the third one is that, as Senior Vice President, I have to repeat this, that come 2026, December 31st, we do not have an ability to provide care, because this is what we do. There's no separation between research and training and clinical care. The care is being provided is informed and driven by the science. What I mean by that is you can treat certain cancers and you cannot treat other ones. If you want to treat the cancers that have no treatment, you have to have that science. You have to drive that innovation in there. pacemaker, bone marrow transplant, my day job, stents, anything, deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's, that all comes from clinical care that is driven by the science. And the third thing that it does is that it brings in the trainees that will carry this forward for all of us. So that is, the sort of the deletion experiment, if you will. What would happen if you don't have it? If you let this merger go in, forward on this timeline in the framework that you have. And then on the other hand, I think we may want to consider that this is an opportunity. You go from disappointment, which I have been disappointed by this behavior, but that's my personal problem, I guess, to the opportunity, because this truly is an opportunity for the state of Minnesota to reframe this, what we would call UMN, University of Minnesota Health. So what this does is, and your question was absolutely perfect, because this is not swapping Fairview for anything else. That's totally opposite. What we have done over the last 5 years is what we call joint clinical enterprise. My academic physicians have co-created with Fairview middle management an environment that is extremely open to access, to high quality care, to high productivity. And we have shown to each other, and I hope to our colleagues in the marketplace, that we can do this. So you have that joint clinical enterprise that we want to keep as a center of gravity, as a point of departure for what comes after 2026. And then we would partner with everyone. We would partner with anybody in the state. We are so lucky and so blessed to have very many non-faculty driven healthcare systems in the state that all benefit from you funding University of Minnesota Medical School, because the physicians are ours, right? They come from us. The innovation comes from us. And it's a beautiful partnership in that way.
Representative Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have many other questions. I'll move on. But I do want to say that this is incredibly complex, and the agreement is in place until 2026. So I do not know that the state of Minnesota needs to commit $1 billion to this at this point when we have so little information about the valuation of the properties, whether charitable or fair market value, whether we really don't have clarity on so many aspects of this agreement. So I personally hope that we allow ourselves the time of the contract to figure this out and what's in the best interest of the state. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice President Franz, you had mentioned that Fairview lost somewhere around $300 million last year, and that's sort of the push for them to merge, and that Sanford is a successful and profitable system. And you had also mentioned about how incredibly expensive this kind of system is, because it's a place where doctors are being trained, and it's you're doing things that nobody else is doing. So just it's inherently very expensive, which kind of bears out when you see Fairview couldn't make it work, at least in this last year. I don't know what their financials were before that. So if we look forward and it's implemented kind of what you're wanting, which is that the university would reacquire this system, these buildings that you currently don't actually own, but you want to reacquire, and you want to tear down East Bank and the entire neighborhood, I've seen the plans, and then rebuild it, that's probably a $5 billion. I'm just on the back of the napkin kind of, it's a big dollar number, whatever the number is. That's a really big endeavor. So if you do all of that and you reacquire all this and you tear down Eastview and you rebuild it for however many billions of dollars that is, and we lose student housing all over surrounding it, that's all gone. And then you've reestablished a system that's expensive inherently, and most likely you'll have budget shortfalls because the way that it's designed, as you explained. Who then will pick up the shortfall? Who's going to fill in the gap? Is it through philanthropy? I mean, what is the plan to make this continue to function? Because if you're continually in deficits, you can't continue to function. So I think the number one question I think that we should be asking is, if that's what you want to do and you want to reacquire all of this and you want to tear down the East Bank Hospital and rebuild it to state-of-the-art, best this, best that, very expensive endeavor, and then move forward, and you're going to be most likely in operating losses, who's paying for that?
Vice President Frank.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. I think, first of all, though, just a side note on the student housing, we fully anticipate, we actually maintain some of the student housing in that area now, and that will be part of that plan in the future, is to make sure there's affordable and student housing going forward. I think one of the things is the plan is not to continue to operate in a deficit. I mean, one of the issues that we've had with the Fairview management, the corporate management of the business, is that the inability to stop the losses, as you indicate. You can't continue to invest in the facilities. You can't continue to attract and retain the very best when you're losing that kind of money. So our plan is that based a lot on what I described earlier about the new treatments that we've been able to come up with, the way that the UMP physicians and the University of Minnesota Medical School work together, we believe that we've created some real opportunities for value, and that we will have to manage those in a way that break even at worst, and then obviously generate positive margins going forward. So our plan is, by separating out the flagship assets from the rest of the Fairview system, we will have an opportunity to manage those those current facilities where we practice the academic health medicine in a way that becomes where we don't lose so much money. Maybe Dean Toler could add to that.
Dean Toler.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, extremely good question that you asked, but I'm going to take a different tact on this. Academic medicine, which is the training and research, is a good business. 7 out of 10 best hospitals in the United States are academic, and they are profitable. The thing that we have signed in 2018, Dr. Hopkins mentioned that treated, you know, that we had with Mr. Herford and his team, that he signed, I signed, my team signed, you know, all the parties signed, was based on the premise that academic medicine is a profitable enterprise. And I still believe that. So how do I know that? Of the 1,700 physicians that I have, you know, in the M physicians, many of them are the highest margin proceduralists that the state has. So the biggest margin that we bring to M Health Fairview is coming from the faculty practice. So it's very profitable. People like me that have been physician scientists can write for medications that nobody else can. They are called CAR-T in oncology. They can be other, you know, but nobody else essentially can, because the companies would not let that do. We bring enormous pharmacy profits to the system, to Fairview. We bring 340B to the system. We bring trainees. We have thousands of trainees, residents and fellows. This is very, very educated, very well trained, and very cheap labor. We have the innovations that you talked about. We have the brand. Collectively, academic medicine is a good business. It just has to be run that way. What we did in 2018 is that Mr. Hereford and his team said, you take care of the doctors, productivity, quality, market share, and be accomplished on all of these metrics. And he takes care with his team of the what size of corporate C-suite he has, what is the revenue cycle, what is the supply chain, what is the premium labor, what is the investment portfolio. Our side of the partnership had nothing to do with these business things. And the part that we are responsible as partners for has worked beautifully. And that is why what we are proposing, the UMN Health, is, in my opinion, going to be a profitable break even, not a huge margin. This is not about a big margin. This is just to break even and run a lean and clean and a patient-responsive business. And that's what exactly we have shown over the last 5 years that we can do, and that's exactly what we plan to do.
Representative O'Neill.
Just to wrap up quickly, Mr. Chair, so if you've got this grand business plan, we'd like to see it, I would think. I think we, the legislature, you're going to be in many committees, would like to see that in numbers and demonstrate it out. Because just like if you're going to go to, you know, a banker and you had to take out a loan for whatever it is, you're going to have to show them your business plan. I think a business plan would be appropriate, and Because right now, as you said, Fairview had a $300 million loss just last year, and they couldn't make a go of it. So I don't know how much of that overall loss is in their system versus what's in your collaboration. I don't know, because that information hasn't been provided. But you did say multiple times in your testimony that this is an inherently expensive endeavor. And so if there's a shortfall, I did ask that question, if there's a shortfall, then who picks that up? I mean, if this grand plan doesn't work out, then who is on the hook, so to speak, to cover that loss?
Members, we're 10 minutes past. I want to continue to go. I have two more people on, Representative Cleaver and Representative McDonald. But we're also losing members because we've gone long. So if Representative Cleaver, you're next, and if you can be brief and to the point, and then Representative McDonald, and then I think we'll call it.
So
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. And to Representative O'Neill's question, I think we need to be able to also see the balance sheets and the profit loss statements of M. Fairview. so that we can understand exactly where Fairview, if they're handling the business deals, sent all of that good money that the University of Minnesota physicians raised for the entity. So I would like to see those financials and to have them presented to the committee. One of the things that I have found very fascinating in this whole conversation is once I realized that the buildings that I have been using, the M. Fairview facilities, whether it's Maple Grove, Edina, or on the central campuses, I thought those were owned by the University of Minnesota. I think many people thought that those M. Fairview buildings were actually owned by the University of Minnesota. I have been mapping every building that has an M. Fairview logo on it. And I am appalled at the state of the structure of our health delivery system. Most of those buildings are owned by equity firms outside of this state. And the reason Fairview is not profitable is because they're paying triple N leases. So the hospital entity is paying the maintenance, the liability, and the property taxes for hedge funds. And I don't understand why that is happening in our medical system, and it has got to have a major impact on the cost of healthcare delivery. So if we're talking about, it cannot be that M. Fairview is not profitable and an outside entity is trying to rush to buy it. Those conversations are incongruent in my mind. There has got to be money here, and I want to know where the money is, and I want to follow the money, and I want to make sure that the public, the Minnesotans, are protected in this deal. And to Representative Robbins' statement, I think she's absolutely right. What is the rush here? Let us see what's happening. I think the Attorney General should be asked to delay this merger or this acquisition until we know where are the state's assets, where did our money go, and why are we paying this much in the healthcare delivery system that is benefiting people on the other side of these equity agreements, and we don't know who they are. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think the last time we heard the phrase follow the money in a legislative or congressional committee, it didn't end well. Representative Dean Toller, or Vice President Friend, you want to respond to that, or I'll go to Representative McDonald? No? All right, Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, because I don't know if you two will be in front of this committee. At the same time, I'm here as well. So a question for you. You were both asserted in the Star and Tribune article that Representative mentioned earlier, yesterday's Star and Tribune article, stating, I just wanted to get your opinion and verify, you said that the doctors at the university were outperforming the Fairview's employed physicians in terms of productivity. So just wondering how you respond to that. What did you mean by that? I guess one can assume what you meant, but I don't want to assume.
Dean Toller, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we know this, you know, from the volume of business that we provide. The FMG, the Fairview Medical Group, and the M Physicians are, you know, it's a little smaller, but it, you know, roughly the same. If you look at the profile, you know, at the comparison to the market productivity, you know, it's pretty clear that the proceduralists on our side, on the M Physician side, are gaining more market share, more business. I'd be happy to, you know, that's the typical sentence here, to provide you more details, you know, in, you know, if you so desire provide more evidence for that.
Lastly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would that be the case with the nurses as well, since my nurse works at the university there?
Dean Toller.
Do they outperform the Fairview's nurses?
Chair Velosky, representative, I don't know. Because the nursing, you know, in this equation, in this business arrangement that we call definitive agreement, is fully on the side of Mr. Hereford. That's the premium labor, that's where.
All right, before I adjourn the committee, I would like, after I adjourn the committee, I'd like to have just a brief conversation with Vice President Franz and Budget Director Donovan, just to set up for what's coming next. So with that, the committee is adjourned.